Welcome to Off Court, the business of sport podcast, where business and sports culture meet. Let's go. Kick it off, Robbie.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Off Court podcast. We're very privileged today to have a silver medalist at the Tokyo 2020 Paralympics. Michael, how you going, man?
Hey, mate. How you doing? Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm going well. We'll just chatting off air briefly, and you've got a little bit of an injury hurdle.
Yeah, a little bit. So the last Thursday, just a bit of a problem with my calf. Running into the last row, just felt a big snap within the calf. So it was quite scary. Everyone thought, yeah, it's gonna be torn or, you know, worse. Turn out on the MRI, basically, that there was pre-existing injury, some sort of scar tissue snapped. So it wasn't the muscle itself. Actually, a really good outcome. Should be back on the track pretty soon. So quite happy with it.
Nice. Yeah, it's always a little bit concerning when you actually hear something happen.
Oh, man. Yeah. And I never heard it before. So, yeah, I was scared, really scared, because it felt like you snap a carrot type of feeling, you know.
So. Yeah. Tell us about your journey, because you've kind of taken, I suppose, a different path, or, you know, you've gone down a different path to, you know, many other athletes. Really keen to kind of learn about your story and how it's, you know, come to this. You know, you've pretty much reached the pinnacle of the sport. Keen to kind of see how, you know, the pieces have kind of come together.
Sure. Where to start? Probably at the very beginning. So probably most of the people, when, you know, they're looking at me, they're like, is something actually wrong with this guy? You know, what's going on? With my impairment, I was born with a club foot, that's the actual term for the condition. What it means is that when I was born, the whole foot basically is deformed. So if you imagine healthy foot, then all the bones basically twisted into the wrong direction. And even the shape of the bones is not, you know, typical. So what happened then was very early, when I was just toddler, there was few surgeries which basically corrected the foot as much, you know, they could into the normal sort of shape. And to be honest, you know, it was 1992 that time, so quite a long ago, and the surgeon, they did a pretty good job. So I was quite fortunate. Then together with obviously the impairment, there is a few issues. So one of the ankle joints is fused, so doesn't move at all, which basically limits a lot the movement of the ankle. And then the second biggest thing is basically I have very minimum strength within the calf. So on the left leg, which is healthy, I can do normal calf raises, no problem. On the right, there is pretty much no way I can raise maybe centimeter.
Wow.
And that's it. So the power loss on the right side is quite big.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because like for me, I find it really interesting to actually hear kind of, you know, how... And there's something else I want to ask you is about sort of the classifications, but, you know, how that's kind of come to be. And I suppose when you're watching on TV, you don't necessarily understand that. So it's really cool to, like, for you to, you know, to share as well, because, you know, it's not something that I would kind of probe out of anyone, but, you know, you're obviously willing to share.
It's a fair question, because even my friends, you know, I never really talked about it, you know. Since little, it's not a thing you want to talk about, and especially when you're young, you know, kids are mean, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
People give you shit like a little chicken, like, you know, so you just stay away from that topic. So growing up, basically, I was growing up with my mom and my grandparents, because my parents, they split very early on. So the first 10, 11 years of my life was mostly with my mom and my grandparents. And the huge influence on me was my grandfather, which was really sport orientated. So from very young age, you know, he would push me into going on bicycle, skiing, you know, all sorts of sport. And basically the fact that I had a problem with my leg, or I couldn't do all the things, that kind of just was not recognized, which is probably a good thing. So that was really good. And then slowly, basically, I started to discover that I can troll really far. So from, you know, age of, I don't know, 6, 7 years old, I was pretty much beating all the adults, you know, when we went canoeing on the river and you had the river, who can throw across. So I would beat all the adults. So that was a good indicator. And based on that, my parents picked the school for me, which was oriented in athletics. So back in Czech Republic, how the system works is slightly different. So up until age of 12, when you're involved in athletics, you don't actually throw javelin, but you throw a cricket ball because it's just less dangerous. You know, kids understand it. Yeah, you just throw both. So doing that, I was really good. I was, winning most of the competitions. I threw the school record. I was ranked first in the Czech Republic. So it was really, really good. And then, coming to like the 13, 14, when basically we say that you have to specialize to certain discipline, that's when I was approached by the athletic club if I want to throw and, try javelin. And that's when I started to throw javelin. But saying that, that was basically all able bodies, because I never really, just based on living with my grandfather and stuff, the impairment was never really considered. So I was like, nah, I compete with able bodies. So up until 2019, I was competing with able bodies. Just
that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you reckon you just had like that mindset instilled in you that like, why should I, I'm throwing further than most other people. Why would I, be classified any differently? And or was it the fact that, you weren't exposed to any other sort of classifications?
I think a bit of both. Like, definitely I didn't have anyone who would sort of suggest it, In the same time, I think it's a bit of ego when you don't really want to admit that, there is a limitation to what you can do. So both of those things. And then basically 2019, I was one day training on our athletic track here in Sandringham, and one of my best friends, Kim, she just cracked a joke. She goes like, I think with your chicken leg, you would classify for para, And I was like, right, I never really thought about it. So inquired about it, basically told the people the story, and they were like, wow, like if you have this, level of impairment, then you definitely, or most likely, you're going to classify based on the requirements, etc. So we started to roll the process, and that's basically how I got classified and started to compete for para.
That's pretty crazy, because it took you to, 27, roughly 26, 27 actually be classified. It's, do you feel like you've kind of, not missed out on, but you had probably another potential, 5, 6, 7 years that you could, you could have gone to another para potentially or two?
No, definitely. Like, it's hard to say, because I think if I didn't experience the journey up until that age, I wouldn't be where I am. In the same time, yes, you can say I would be already competing at Paralympics at age of 18, most likely. Based on my results, I would be probably winning those competition up until, now. So it's like, yes, I could have achieved all of that. I could have, but it's could have,
I'm sure you've got no regrets, because you've achieved a lot. But wait, so when did you come out to Australia, and what was kind of the reason behind that?
So I came 2012, September. So it's going to be this September, it's going to be 10 years. I basically finished the high school, which I studied. It was a 4 years of mechanical engineering with graduation. Finished that. And in that time, what happened as well was I was still competing. I was doing quite well in terms of juniors. I basically made the junior national team preparing for the European Championship with able bodies. And within that year, coming very close to the season, my bad leg basically started to hurt really bad, the area of the ankle. And so I basically visit a few doctors in Czech Republic, and the doctors basically just said like, look what sort of impairment you have. You should be, happy that you actually can walk, can run, and you're trying to do professional sport, so.
How did that, did that fire you up, or was that kind of like a down period? Like, did that affect you?
It struck me down. It was really hard to hear, because I came there for a solution, I'm like, what do we do to fix this? And the solution just was not there, So I was really down, really, really sad, because obviously my plan for the future was like, I'm gonna compete, I'll be athlete. And that suddenly seemed impossible. So I couldn't really compete, so I still kept training, but it was really not so motivating anymore without knowing that you can't really compete. And that time, basically my uncle approached me saying that he's got a friend in Melbourne. And that's where the opportunity came. All right, well, I can't do athletics that much. Let's at least go and learn language, you know, because I just finished high school, so I need some extra skill. So yeah, I said yes, basically straight away. My parents couldn't believe it. They were like, you can't speak English. Like, where are you going? You know? And my dad kept cracking jokes like, oh, I just want to see what you're going to do there. You literally can't speak English. So yeah, then, you know, suddenly I'm on the airport, you know, catching the plane, flying to Germany, then straight to Australia through, I think it was through Seoul. Already on the plane, they asking me what I want for a meal. You know, I just don't understand what they're saying. So go to Australia, met with my uncle's friend, which became one of my best friends here. He basically helped me to stay with him for first, you know, 2-3 months. And helped me to find job, which was basically just doing a kitchen hand within the Italian restaurant. So I was the first 2 months just washing dishes, trying to learn the English. In the same time, I had a course of English in the CBD, which was four days a week, was going to basically learn English in the classes. But for me, you know, I'm quite a bad student, so that didn't really work for me.
Did you find, like, because obviously Australia is very multicultural, mm-hmm. and my grandparents are from Italy. Did you find, like, there's little do you find, like, your Czech community here? Like, I find that, like, it's really good of, you know, for example, the Italian community is very good at sort of coming together. And I know, you know, with other countries as well, it's, you kind of form little communities. Did you find yours?
Nah, look, to be honest, I had the opposite approach because, as we said before, I was quite angry with, you know, the whole doctor's opinion and stuff. You can't do this and that. So I was quite over it, you know. So I'm like, I need to leave. And I didn't really want to have anything to do, you know, with Czech at the time. I was like, you want to learn English, you can't be in Czech community. You have to be between Aussies. That's how you're going to learn English. So I didn't look for the community at all. Like, never really looked for it. Because within the first 3 months being here, the mentality of people, the style of life, everything, I just loved it. You know, it was very different, you know, compared to back there. Everything is so judgmental, you know, people judging on everything, what you have, what you don't have, etc. You know, if I say it exaggerated, you can walk out on the street in pyjama and no one will give a crap, you know, like that. So it's like, it's just so friendly and cool, you know. Compare.
Did you get any culture shock when you came here with anything?
No, not really. No, I really loved it. Like, I within that first 3 months, I said to my parents, like, I'm not going back. And they were like, oh, come on, like, you've been there 3 months, you're saying this, you know, you will change your tune. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. So I felt kind of determined to prove them wrong as well. But as I said, 3 months in, and I was like, nah, I'm staying.
That's good to hear, though. Like, it's good to hear that you kind of, you know, able to kind of not fit in, I don't think that's the right word, but just kind of find your place and really kind of enjoy the surroundings pretty much straight away.
For sure.
Without knowing English either. I mean, you know, you listen to you now and it's, you know, fluent. So that's really something in itself. Tell me about Tokyo and how that all came together, because from 2019 you got the classification, and then obviously 2020 was a write-off, and then 2021 it all kind of came together. So tell me about that kind of 2 years leading in, and then obviously the event itself.
Yeah, so that write-off year, as you said, I actually appreciated it here because that gave me opportunity just to train, you know. Even it was very limited, it was lockdowns, etc. In that time I still wasn't in VIS, the Institute of Sport, so I didn't have the option of using the facility yet because I was still going through the process of being classified, etc. So it was a lot of improvising, training from the garage, then going out on the field. And I kind of enjoyed it, you know, because I was like, I don't have a gym, but there is suddenly whole heaps of other things you can do, which usually you would probably not work on. So for me, it was stabilizing the shoulders, doing a lot of core, you know, not having such a heavy weight because you just can't use such a heavy weight in the garage. So end up doing a lot of training with lighter weights, but fast, you know, higher volume, adjusted to the situation really, and, you know, made the best out of it. Then that year, basically, we needed to, you need to qualify. So the season usually starts around December and continues up until April. So that was my window where I needed to throw the qualifier. And pretty much the first competition, I already threw the qualifier by 2 meters, but because it wasn't competition which was certified, it was not recognized. So it was a really good indicator. It kind of gave me peace of mind. All right, I already threw it. I just need to do it again. So then the next few competitions, I just proved it and basically threw the legitimate qualifiers. Within that period, I had a little problem with Achilles. So still kind of knew I'm not prepared, you know, 100%. There is still lots of things I can improve if I'm healthy. And also in that time, I was still working for the other company, which I was working for past 5 years. I was second in charge for a removal company. And that's basically where I met my previous boss, which is one of my best friends. And I grew so much within the company because Vinny just, you know, helped me a lot. Such a nice guy and really, really good experience. But saying that, I started to realize that doing that job and trying to compete at the highest level just wasn't, you know, it was no longer possible. So sometimes you miss training, you know, you come home tired, etc. So had to make the change. And then basically where I made the decision was just the June 21, which was quite close to Tokyo already. And I had a stress fracture because we had a big job. Everyone jumped on board and there was a lot of stair work, you know, and I developed a stress fracture. So there was a massive setback for me. So I decided to change the jobs, find something where I can lock in the time, 7:30, 3:30, train outside of it and have a routine. So coming, leading up to Tokyo, had to deal with the stress fracture. Once again, I couldn't jump, couldn't run, had to keep it, you know, rested. It was really, really, really tough time. You need to be, you want to perform your best and suddenly you can't do the most important things. You know? So mentally it was very challenging, but again, probably same mindset as during the lockdown period where I just trained the garage. It was have to make the best out of it. So did everything else except, you know, using that left leg.
What about your experience at Tokyo? Like obviously, you know, the event itself, you performed incredibly. But what about the experience, like just being around, you know, elite athletes, the games, like obviously from behind the scenes look phenomenal, like just the technology. And what was your experience? Was it overwhelming?
For me, first of all, it was awesome because, you know, it was like Christmas for a kid first time, you know.
I bet.
I loved every moment of it, that's for sure. But in the same time, from my experience, I knew that I can't get overexcited because from my experience, it just drains you when you think too much about the situation, think too much about the performance. So I was really, really cold, kind of not thinking about it. Yes, I'm here, but I got job to do. So
well, it worked for you.
Yeah. So all the way up until the competition, I wasn't really thinking about competing. And that's kind of my strategy before every competition. You know, once I'm on the warm-up track, that's when I'm like, okay, now it's time to start, you know, making the plan. What are we going to do? And the basic key is just to stick to the basic. This is what makes the good throw, few cues, and just doing that. Basically, what we're practicing in the training, for me, it's like we've done it 1,000 times. Now I just need to do the same thing again, but with 100% capacity.
Did you have expectations going in? Like, did you have an expectation that, hey, I realistically think I can medal here? Or was it more of going in just going, I'm going to enjoy this and see what happens?
No, I went in saying that I'm getting medal. That was for me. If I didn't get the medal, I would be, you know, shattered. Like, so the medal was the plan. Like, we go there, we get a medal. And yeah, then the night of the competition came, just stick to the original plan, as I said. And then you just walk into the stadium, you know, and it's massive. You know, you see the lights, the speaker is going, and it's just like from the TV, you know, the every competition you watch on the YouTube, you know, since 12 years old, and you're dreaming about that. Suddenly you're standing there, and I just couldn't stop smiling. I was like, wow, this is great, you know, awesome. And then I saw the other guys. Basically, there was a couple guys which I knew they're really good. They can throw really far. One of them was the world record holder in my category. I knew, you know, he's a great thrower. But in the waiting room, I saw him. He looked nervous, you know. And I was like, okay, this guy is nervous. You know, that plays for me. So try to stay cool. And yeah, man, went out there. The whole competition, I was kind of struggling with getting the right position of my shoulder. Just to explain it, I call it sort of like a lock position. So because the whole throw is about transferring power as much possible from the ground. So everything starts from the legs and you're transferring up into the shoulder and into the throw. So if you imagine the shoulder, it's like a big leverage, like a slingshot. And the way to achieve that, you kind of need to lock in the shoulder and stay in there and then just wait for the energy to come through. So I wasn't really achieving that. It just happens. Sometimes you feel it, sometimes you don't. So I was really struggling with it. And then the last throw came. I was on the third position and I'm like, shit, you know, like this is the last throw, like now or never. So just gathered everything together. Really was thinking about locking it in. And yeah, happened. Everything went through into the javelin and through 3 meter PB and moved to second position. So, That was the difficult part, obviously, because the whole venue, the Olympic Village, kind of was restricted. You really shouldn't leave the village, so we couldn't leave the village. And then our team make extra precautions. So we, you know, all the other countries basically were going to dining hall, like nothing is happening. Our team did really well, basically just preserving us within the building. They set up everything downstairs, like, we didn't have to go to dining hall. We had all the meals downstairs and everything. So when it came to celebrating, someone sneaking, you know, a few beers, etc. And basically with a few friends, we just celebrated, you know, downstairs at the building and probably went to sleep at 4 a.m. And 10 o'clock the following morning, they're calling me, oh, you got an interview in Channel 7, you know, live. Next hour, I was like, wow, super hangover, absolute nightmare, and great experience. We're actually planning to go to Thailand and meet with everyone the end of the year for Christmas, and most likely that's where we're going to do our wedding. That's probably the opportunity where, you know, everything comes together after so many years. Thank you for reaching out and having me on. Thank you.